How's everybody doing? We are glad you're here. My name is Noel. I'm one of the pastors. And if you're new to RIV, we're one church that meets in four locations around the Lansing area. So no matter what venue you're at, we're glad you're here. And I guess we're actually five venues because we have the VIP lounge down the hallway. So hi to everybody down in the VIP lounge. This is a big weekend, right? I mean, Batman versus Superman came out. And by the way, my family, we're really into superhero movies, and we haven't seen this one yet, which means if you tell me anything about the movie, I know it's Easter, but I'll kill you. And the thing is, Jesus will forgive me because that's the point of Easter. So we love the superhero movies, and especially this one because I'm a big Batman fan. In my basement, I have a box of wrapped comic books that are not for reading, but for sitting in the box. And that proves that I'm actually a Batman fan. And then my wife was a fan of Wonder Woman throughout the 70s. And so we're really excited about this particular movie. And I've been thinking a lot about why it is that we as Americans have gotten so into this superhero narrative lately, and why there's so many superhero movies. And I think it's indicative of our culture. We like really big stories. We like really surreal stories. We like really supernatural stories. And really, this story that we're talking about today, the Easter story, is the biggest of them all. It's the surrealist story, the supernaturalist story that there is out there. I mean, think about this story. We're talking about the idea that the God of the universe, who created everything, decided to step into his own creation. And in stepping into his own creation, he became the smallest, most unexpected, most seemingly insignificant person to actually save the world. And yet he did. And he saved the world from its greatest enemy, death. And so for Christians, this isn't just a story. This is a true story. In fact, our faith rises and falls on the truthfulness of this story. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to walk through the Easter story today. And for many of us, if we grew up in the church, we're very familiar with this, but let it just wash over you again today. For those of you who are new to this Jesus thing, this may be brand new to you. This is what we believe. This is the core of our faith. And so if you have a Bible, you can flip or tap your way to Matthew 27. If you don't have one, no big deal. The verses will be on the screen. But the context going into Matthew 27 is this. Jesus had spent 3 years walking the earth, or he'd spent 33 years walking the earth, but 3 years doing ministry. And part of his ministry was he had a teaching ministry, and his teaching was so remarkable that it still kind of reverberates out and impacts our world 2,000 years later. I mean, Jesus said crazy stuff like, I want you to love your enemies. I not only want you to love your enemies, I want you to forgive them when they do things that cause them to be your enemy, right? He said not only that, he said, I want you to love them, I want you to forgive them, and I want you to pray for them. I want you to pray that God would do good things in their lives. I mean, that's a crazy thing. Jesus went on to say, if you hate somebody, it's just as bad as if you had murdered them. And then he says, well, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. I came to separate families. When I'm here, and people who believe in me, it's going to separate mom and dad from the kids from the dads, and the brothers from sisters. And so his teaching was remarkable. And then he performed miracles. I mean, Jesus turned water into wine, and then he walked on some other water, and he healed a blind person so that they could see and helped the lame to walk. But more than anything, more than even his teaching and his miracles, what's remarkable about Jesus is his life. See, Jesus faced every single temptation that any of us will ever face. He was tempted to sexual sin. He was tempted to greed or to hunger for power or to have unrighteous anger. And yet he didn't succumb to any of that temptation. And what we in the church will call that, we call succumbing to that temptation sin. And so what that means is that Jesus was sinless. He lived an absolutely perfect life. And so when you add up kind of the miracles and the teachings and the life, Jesus really builds this legendary resume that would cause some of the Jews of that time to say, maybe this was the one. See, they have been waiting for a hero to come, one that would set the captive free and one that would set the entire universe right. And you read the Old Testament, you just see that they were always looking for this guy. But when Jesus showed up, he wasn't what they expected him to be. I mean, instead of jumping onto the throne in Jerusalem to immediately grab power, Jesus served people. He served people that were rejected by others, and he played with little kids, and he defended oppressed women, and the Jews just didn't know what to do with this guy. And so they trumped up a bunch of charges against him, and after he was convicted, he was to be sentenced to death, and the death that he was sentenced to was to be crucified to a cross, which is to have his hands nailed to a beam of a cross and his feet nailed to a beam of a cross, and they erected this cross on a place called Skull Hill and then jammed a crown of thorns on his head to mock him as a king, and even put a sign above him that said, "Here's Jesus, King of the Jews," right? And so that's where we are when we hit Matthew 27. And we are in verse 45, where it says, "Now from the sixth hour there was darkness all over the land until the ninth hour." And so that's noon to three. "And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" And so what is happening in this 3 hours where everything in the world grows dark? Well, remember, Jesus was sinless. He lived that sinless, perfect life that we could never live. And so what's happening on the cross is all of our sins that we've ever committed, all the sins we have not committed yet, all the sins we're dreaming of committing next week, all the sins that anyone in the entire world has ever committed were poured out on top of Jesus during that 3 hours. And then on top of all the sins of all the world was all the wrath of God, the righteous anger of God toward that sin, the punishment for that sin was poured out next on top of that. And so this dark period of 3 hours is when Jesus is feeling the full weight of the sin of the world and the punishment of God. The book of Romans describes it this way: "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." And that's what was happening in those 3 hours. Jesus was suffering and Jesus was dying. Now, I don't know if you've ever watched or listened to the Serial podcast. And by the way, I'm not going to spoil anything about it because I don't want you to spoil the movie, and we have a deal. And so the Serial podcast this season is about Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who is the guy who was traded for the five Taliban soldiers from Guantanamo Bay. And one of the conversations kind of threaded through his entire narrative is, was this worth it? Should we have traded these five dudes for this dude? If people had died in the course of trying to find him, would that have been worth it? Because that's the question we ask. You know, when there's a rescue situation or one person dies for another, we always ask that question: was that giving of that life worth it? Was the price that was paid too high? And if you were to ask Jesus that question, was the price too high? He'd say no. But if you really thought about it, it's hard to reconcile. I mean, think about this. I mean, what does this verse say? "Though perhaps for a good person, one would dare even to die," right? If we knew someone was a really good person, for that person, we might be willing to give up our life. But Jesus gave up his life for all of the despicable sinners that have ever lived in the entire universe, including you and me. And you say to Jesus, "Is that worth it?" And he would say, "Yes." And then you'd say, "Well, Jesus, do you know me? Do you know the things I've done and things I've thought?" He'd say, "Yeah, I know you better than you know you." And you say, "Is it still worth it?" And Jesus would say, "Yes, because I love you." Now, for a second, think about the punishment that Jesus went through, the one that he felt was worth it. On the cross, he screams out, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And that word "scream" there, or the word "cry," is the word "scream." Jesus screams this out. Jesus, who is supposed to be the hero, Jesus, who is purportedly on mission to save the world, Jesus, who is God in the flesh, screams. What does he scream? He screams, "God, Dad, you failed me, you left me, what is going on?" Now, by the way, there are people who think that the gospel accounts were made up, and for many of them who think it's made up, this is a troubling verse. Because if you are writing a hero narrative at precisely the moment that hero is supposed to do the big thing, they don't freak out and yell, oh God, why am I doing this, right? That doesn't happen at the very last second. Tim Keller, who's a pastor of a church in New York, he preached a sermon once, and I never forget what he said about this. He said Jesus was so poised through the whole trial. He was poised when he was being tortured. He didn't answer his accusers. He was nailed to the cross, and he was poised. And then there was this moment where he broke. And he broke not physically, he broke spiritually. Because as all the weight of the sin of the world was on him and all the judgment of God was on him, he felt for the first time in his entire existence the utter loss of being separated from God for all eternity. See, Jesus had always been with God for all eternity past, and now in this moment, he doesn't have that. He's feeling death, not just physical, but Jesus felt death spiritual. And this is why the cross is so important. Because if Jesus had not gone to the cross for us, then the suffering that he went through that caused him to scream would be the suffering that we would go through. But because he suffered and he screamed, we never have to face the suffering that caused the scream. So he screams out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he's actually quoting someone. That's King David, who said this, my God, who, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me, they mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. They say, he trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Now, when David wrote this, David was writing it because he was truly experiencing it. But he didn't know that he was also writing a prophecy about Jesus who would go through that same thing. In fact, he got to the point where earlier in the story, the part I didn't read, there were people standing at the foot of the cross saying to Jesus, he trusts in the Lord, let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. I love how David ends this psalm. He says, all the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you, for kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth eat and worship. Before him shall bow all who go down to the dust, even the one who could not keep himself alive. Posterity shall serve him. It shall be told of the Lord to the coming generations. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. So what is Jesus saying when he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, he's crying out that he's actually experiencing this and that this prophecy about him was true. Not just the first part, the whole, I am being crushed, where are you, God? But the end part where Jesus is king. The end part where Jesus is king, and it says, it will be declared, proclaimed to a people yet unborn, that's you, that he has done it, the work he did on the cross. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook and the rocks were split and the tombs also were opened. And many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tomb after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. Now here Jesus screams again, but this time we don't have words because there are no words. This scream is a guttural, visceral scream of death. But in that moment, something remarkable happens. In fact, it's one of the most overlooked parts of the Easter story, one of my favorites. It's almost like death was holding on, and death just began to lose his grip Because in that moment when Jesus died, he just let a couple go and a couple people came back to life. And then they wandered into the city. Imagine that. Hey, my mother-in-law's back, right? Now, what's remarkable about that is that Matthew is writing this 30 years after it took place. So it was a pretty recent account. There would have been people who were alive back then. They're like, yeah, I remember. Mom came back, totally came back, right? And so he's writing that. What is happening in that moment? Well, this is how I like to think about it. I like to think of it like a thunderstorm. You know when you hear a thunderstorm coming, it's just starting to rumble, and it rolls in the distance, that sound. I think that's what's happening. It's that roll, and you know it's coming. And then eventually you hear that crack, right? And that crack is still to come in the story. See, what's remarkable about these people raising from the dead as the first, you know, is death began to let go, but it's just as remarkable what happened in the temple. See, the temple was a place of barriers. There was a barrier that said, if you're not Jewish, you can't come past this barrier. And then there's a barrier that said, if you're not a man, you can't come past this barrier. And then there was a barrier that said, if you're not a priest, you can't come past this barrier. And then there's a barrier that said, if you're not the high priest, you can't come past this barrier. And that spot that the high priest could go, he could only go once a year. And when he went, he had to bring blood with him, all right? And this part was blocked off with a 60-foot tall curtain that Jewish tradition will tell you is about a hand's breadth wide. And that might be a little bit of an exaggeration. It was either a big curtain like that, or it was like layers of curtains that were kind of like a maze. So it's kind of hard to get through, to get through back to that area. And that final barrier had that Holy of Holies, where one priest, one time a year, could bring one blood sacrifice. And the very structure of the temple said this: you are not good enough to go in here. Only one guy can come, only one time a year, and only when he's representing the people with a blood sacrifice. And when Jesus died on the cross, he became not only our sacrifice, he became our high priest, offering himself as the blood sacrifice. And death just began to lose its grip. That curtain was torn from the top to bottom, symbolizing that there was now no barrier between God and people. So Jesus was taken down and he was placed into the tomb, and a stone was rolled in front of it and some guards were set in front. And it says, now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. All right, they passed out. So it's like you've got these trained military dudes pass out when they see the angel, which helps us. So if anyone ever comes to you and say, oh, I saw an angel, you can say, wow, did you pass out? Because the appropriate reaction seems to be fear throughout Scripture, unless the angel is in disguise, and then you don't know because the angel's in disguise. But the angel said to the women, and please note the women did not pass out. I'm just going to let that hang out there. But the angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen. As he said, come see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee, and there you will see him. See, I've told you. It's like he said, that's my job. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came up and took a hold of his feet and worshiped him. And then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. When we see in the stories, death just lets go. And this surreal, supernatural story is Easter. Now, the danger in this is to treat this story the way we treat Batman versus Superman. You go see the story, you hear the story, and you go, that was a good story. What's for brunch? And right? And you just kind of move on. And yet you miss the crucial piece if you do that. And the crucial piece is that you're a character in the story. You were the one in the story that needed to be saved, that needed to be rescued. You were the one that Jesus said, I have to figure out what price to pay. He didn't have to figure it out. It was always the plan, but you know, a little hyperbole there. He says, there is not a high enough price for me to pay for you. You were the one that needed to be rescued. And deep down, you know it. Every one of us, no matter how good and moral we are, somewhere inside of us, there's that spot where we just know. We know we've lied. We know we've cheated. We know we've manipulated some people. There's that thing that we can't stop doing, that we wish we could stop doing. It just keeps kind of coming up. And we're like, why can't I stop doing that? Because sin nature. You have a sin nature. And what that means is you can't save yourself. You need a savior that does not have that sin nature. You need a savior that is not only fully man so that he could stand in your place and pay your price for you, but can also be fully God so he can do that for all of the world and so that he can conquer sin, Satan, and conquer death. And we have that hero in Jesus, the God-man, who is sinless, yet beat sin by becoming sin and beat death on the cross. And all Jesus asks of us is that we believe. So believe. Trust in Jesus to save you, and he will never let you go. And just like he took your sin, he will give you his goodness and his perfection and his righteousness, his good standing with God, so that you will never, ever have to be separated from God the Father for all eternity. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age." And by the way, the verse right before that one said that when Jesus appeared, some of them believed and some of them doubted. And it didn't even matter. Jesus kept moving on. What does that mean? Well, some of us here are doubting this whole story. It's okay. Doubt it for a while. Let Jesus work with you. He's going to work on your life. I mean, Jesus ends up telling these people, listen, I want you to go be my messengers now. I want you to go now tell everybody about me. I want you to tell them about my miracles. I want you to tell them about my teachings and tell them about my life and tell them about my death, burial, and resurrection. Tell them about what was about to happen, his ascension in heaven. I want you to tell them all of that. And then when they believe, I want you to baptize them. Well, why would you baptize them? Well, because baptism is preaching that story again. It's taking someone and placing them underwater to symbolize Jesus' death, then bringing them up out of the water, symbolizing his new life. It's the water symbolizing the cleansing of their sin. And so every time someone is baptized, they preach the gospel to us again. This weekend at RIV, across our whole church, we've got about 60 people who at different services are preaching the gospel to us through baptism. And I just want you to meet a couple of them.
The main reason essentially that I started coming to church was my girlfriend and fiance of 9 years recently split up. And I was having a real hard time with coping with that. I've battled numerous drug addictions, self-mutilation, and I didn't really have any coping skills once I kind of cut all that stuff out of my life. So when this happened, I didn't really know how to cope with it or deal with it.
I was raised Catholic and was baptized as an infant, but the Catholic Church didn't do a lot with salvation story and that kind of thing.
Grew up never coming to church. Really, I'd go to church like once a year whenever my grandma would come and then she'd take us and then it'd be that time. But then I recently just started coming to RIV last year when my dad invited me to come.
There was one Sunday that I missed, and that was because I got in a really bad car accident. I remember that morning, it was like negative 10 out. I was on M52 on my way home and started kind of falling asleep. And I just kind of sat up in my chair, you know, and I was like, all right, you got this. You can put this together, just another, you know, 10 minutes and you'll be home. And I didn't make it. I remember hitting a mailbox, and that's what woke me up. There was a driveway that crossed the ditch with a culvert, went straight up in the air and then straight down. It rolled numerous times. I can't tell you how many times. It was a wild ride. When the truck finally settled and, you know, the dust cleared, basically, I was still kind of out of it, and I didn't realize, you know, am I dead? Am I alive? I just had this feeling, basically, that I wasn't alone and that God was there protecting me the whole time, because by the laws of physics, I really probably should have died, you know. And right then and there, I mean, standing in the negative 10 degree weather, I kind of analyzed my life for the past few weeks from the time that Ashley and I split up and realized that I was, even though I was going to church, I was still living a very reckless life. From that point on, I decided to, you know, to kind of put all that stuff behind me, to focus on what's best for my family. And I firmly believe that that's, you know, that's God and that's Jesus.
Being alive together with Jesus, having him next to me, guiding my path, helping me with decisions in my life every day, that's what I believe.
I don't have a lot of great things going for me, I guess, but I'm more content with my life right now than I ever have been.
Seeing other adults get baptized and their reasons for baptism and hearing the preaching about baptism, I really wanted to make a commitment myself, a reaffirmation that, yes, I believe that's what Jesus wants us to do.
It's an outward expression of your faith in Jesus.
That you are fully submitting yourself to him.
You've got to realize that you've already been saved. Your baptism is just showing to everybody around you that you realize that, you know, that Jesus did die for us.
Proclaiming your faith in public.
I'm a follower of Jesus.
God is the answer that I can really look for salvation.
I want to exercise my own decision-making power as an adult and decide that, yes, that's what I want for my life, is to be baptized.
My name is Jacob Oliver. I am choosing to be baptized today.
My name is Ben, and I'm choosing to be baptized today.
My name is Cricket Lott, and I choose to be baptized today.